By the way, I would interject, a listener last week was offended at the sarcasm that I'm using here. This is not because I don't sympathize with the victims in these cases. Obviously, I do sympathize with them. The sarcasm is because of the relative quiet and obscurity in which they've gone. Again, I, at the risk of seeming a trifle priggish, I'm a militantly compassionate person. That's why I do programs like this kind. You won't hear many people, if anybody, these days doing something like this. My sarcasm here is not because I have not out of disregard for these individuals. It's out of disregard for the society which lets them go so quietly. The San Francisco Chronicle of Wednesday, May 31st of 1984, carried another obituary that I think we should look at in much the same vein as the death of Judge Patricia McKinley. This is a UPI story, Dateline Chicago. Its headline, Leonita McLean. Chicago Tribune columnist Leonita McLean, the first black member of the newspaper's editorial board, was found dead in her South Side home, an apparent suicide, police said yesterday. Police said McLean, 32, was found in bed at Tuesday night by former Tribune reporter James Younger, a friend who was asked by Tribune employees to check on her after she failed to show up at work Monday or Tuesday. McLean was last seen at a family picnic Sunday, police said. Police Lieutenant Richard Shinners, S-H-I-N-N-E-R-S, said three empty pill bottles and a note were found next to McLean's body. He said the medication in the bottles had not been determined, but the note, quote, indicated she wished to take her life and alluded to a general feeling of depression. McLean joined the Tribune as a part-time employee in the classified advertising department while she attended Chicago State University. She came to national prominence with an article published in the Washington Post on July 24, 1983. She came to national prominence with an article published in the Washington Post on July 24, 1983, discussing the racial tensions that accompanied the election of Harold Washington as Chicago's first black mayor. I would take note that Harold Washington himself died of a heart attack under questionable circumstances not long ago. A couple of other, another interesting article, that obituary in the very same paper. In fact, two columns over from that of Leonita McLean, Mexican columnist slain. AP Mexico City. Manuel Buendia, front page columnist for the daily newspaper Excelsior, was shot to death yesterday evening as he walked outside his office, a newspaper official said. The official Federico Ortiz said Buendia was shot in the back by unknown assailants almost in front of his office in the Zona Rosa, a tourist and business district in the downtown area. No other details were available immediately. Buendia's columns ranged from economics to international politics. He was known as a critic of U.S. policies in Central America. I would add other obituaries of Manuel Buendia indicated that he had written extensively about the CIA in Mexico and in Central America, had also written about the Opus Dei, a reactionary pro-fascist lay organization in the Catholic Church very close to Pope John Paul II, and he had also written about the Los Tecos neo-Nazi group and branch of the World Anti-Communist League in Guadalajara. Incidentally, the fellow named Gerhard Mertens, a former cohort of Otto Skorzeny's in the SS and head of Merex, a West German-based arms trafficking firm which has served as a front for BND activities, the BND being the third and final incarnation of the Gehlen organization, was in an article which we're going to download very soon, named as a suspect in the murder of Manuel Buendia. Should be known, too, that, as I indicated, speaking of Central America, it is no longer in Central and Latin America that one finds desaparecidos. Well, certainly people are being disappeared there, but political activists are being disappeared here, people active on behalf of minorities and others. Following story is from the San Francisco Chronicle of Wednesday, October 21st of 1987. In the Bay Area Report section, we find the following story, datelined Berkeley and headlined, UC Students Aid Search for Official. University of California students have joined the search for a UC official who has been missing for over a month. Charles Tunstall, capital T-U-N-S-T-A-L-L, 38, vanished on September 14th. The director of the university's Minority Engineering Program, a special program designed to help recruit and retain black engineering students, was last seen in his campus office on Sunday, September 13th. Tunstall's car was found the next day in San Francisco's Seacliff area. University employees and students joined Oakland police in a search for Tunstall on the hiking trails near the Pacific coastline where his car was discovered, but found nothing. Tunstall, an Oakland resident, is black, bearded, 6 feet 2 inches tall, and weighs 160 pounds. He has a gold cap on the tooth between his incisor and right front tooth and usually wears a silver interlocking bracelet. Anyone with information about his whereabouts is asked to contact Sergeant Dan Murray at the Oakland Police Department, and they give that phone number. Story sounds very similar to the following story. Research credit on this to a listener who read this on the air last week and has sent me the actual article. This is from the Daily Californian. That is the newspaper of the University of California at Berkeley. This from the issue of Tuesday, October 18th of 1988. This is an article by Emilio Castaneda. It's called Activist Missing from 40-Day Fast. A homeless rights activist, that's to say not a homeless rights activist, but an activist on behalf of the rights of the homeless, a homeless rights activist who embarked on a 40-day fast September 27th to protest the problem of homelessness in Berkeley has been missing for more than 2 weeks. Michael Cochran had fasted 4 days when he left for Sacramento on October 1st and has not returned since, according to his spokesperson, Susan Marsh. Michael has been known to get up and leave, Marsh said, but he has always told someone to let us know where he is, unquote. So far, we've contacted the police, she said. We're also looking into our own contacts right now. Bob Sparks, the owner of the trailer Marsh was using during Cochran's fast, said he filed a missing persons report October 11th, but has not yet received a response from police. Sparks said he also spoke with city officials to see whether Cochran had been arrested in connection with two previous protests. Lieutenant Pat Phelps said yesterday he had not heard anything about the case. Cochran, who was fasting in a show of solidarity with national homeless rights activist Mitch Snyder, had received a permit to park the trailer near Civic Center Park for the duration of his fast, Marsh said. Michael was looking for the appropriate action to end homelessness, Marsh said. He was afraid that during the election frenzy, the problem would be ignored. Marsh said Cochran planned his fast independently. We didn't talk with the Berkeley Oakland Support Services or other groups, Marsh said. No election candidates were being targeted by the fast, she said. The only reason he did it was to call attention to homelessness. Michael was very committed to doing this, which is what makes his sudden disappearance strange, Sparks said. We have our suspicions Michael may have run into foul play. Sparks said Michael was just a social activist who had no real enemies. Everyone who has worked with Michael is really concerned because when you're homeless, anything can happen, Sparks said. People have to get in off the street where even the police can't protect you, which is what Michael was trying to do. Despite Cochran's disappearance, the trailer is still parked on Center Street in Marsh, and Marsh said there are no plans to remove it until the permit expires on Election Day. We are going to leave it as a symbolic demonstration. Well, one of the most tragic aspects of this article, I think, and this is not to put down Sparks here, but Michael was just a social activist who had no real enemies. Well, as I think recent events have made only too clear, social activists in this country have real enemies, albeit not personal enemies. There are a lot of people who do not tolerate social activism. Another desaparecido was reported in the San Jose Mercury News of Saturday, November 30th of 1985. This article is headlined, Searches On for Missing San Jose State Worker. San Jose police and a private investigator are looking for 22-year-old Robert Edson, E-D-S-O-N, who disappeared November 17th from his downtown apartment on East St. James Street. No trace has been found since Edson walked away from his roommates, leaving behind all his personal belongings, including a car. While there is no evidence of foul play, said Sergeant Joe Weinreb, the behavior is very uncharacteristic of him, unquote. Edson, who is not a student, had been in San Jose for several months working on the San Jose State University campus for a Berkeley-based national student organization involved in the research of public interest issues. The group is called the California Public Interest Research Group, or CalPERG. Fellow roomers last saw him the evening of November 17th, relaxing and working late in the apartment in preparation for a regional conference of organization representatives in Los Angeles. Edson left the building and never returned, nor did he show up for the meeting, police said. Again, remains to be seen what happened with Mr. Edson. A very famous case in right here in the Bay Area concerned the hanging of Timothy Lee. Supposedly a suicide, there are indications that Timothy Lee was actually, in fact, murdered. Story on the Timmy Lee killing appeared in the San Jose Mercury on Sunday morning, January 26th of 1986. It's by Abby Cohn and Ann Hagedorn of the San Jose Mercury News staff. Statelined Concord, headlined, Hanged Black's Family, Certain He Was Lynched. To his family, the image of Timothy Lee's body hanging from a tree in Concord last November conjures up a horrifying specter of racial violence in America, the lynching of a black man. It's an image that Lee's family and friends have not been able to shake, and an image that will not allow them to accept the conclusion of police that the 23-year-old fabric designer took his own life the morning of November 2nd. From the very start, his family was convinced that someone killed Lee because he was black and gay, and they say they won't rest until a murderer is found. Like they say, they strung up the wrong nigger this time, said Lee's sister Tammy, who helped spur an FBI investigation of the incident. Stranded at the Concord BART station about 1 a.m. November 2nd after he fell asleep on the train, Lee tried unsuccessfully to get a ride home to Berkeley with friends. 11 hours later, just past noon on a Saturday, his body was found hanging from a fig tree in a vacant lot near the BART station. Citing an apparent suicide note, a blood alcohol level of 0.13, and no signs of a struggle, Concord police and the Contra Costa County coroner ruled Lee's death a suicide. Well, there are a lot of questions concerning the death of Timothy Lee, and just some of the discrepancies in the case were discussed in another San Jose Mercury News article. This from the San Jose Mercury News of Tuesday morning, March 13th of 1986. Quote, suicide notes author disputed. Hanged man's roommate wrote it, expert says. Los Angeles handwriting expert Andrea McNicholas told police that Timothy Lee's roommate wrote the purported suicide note discovered near the tree in Concord where the 23-year-old black man was found hanging in November. It was the latest surprise in a strange case in which the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People and Lee's family originally alleged that racists, possibly connected to the Ku Klux Klan, killed Lee because he was black and gay. Three other handwriting experts have said Lee's roommate, Russell E. Wright, a salesman at an outdoor clothing store, did not write the note. But Concord police, criticized since Lee's death for not aggressively investigating the possibility that Lee did not commit suicide, were to interview Wright on Wednesday night. I'm very upset and I'm hurt. Suddenly I'm a suspect. It's unbelievable, Wright said Wednesday from his job in San Francisco. He was sharing a studio apartment with Lee in Berkeley at the time of the fabric designer's death. Skipping down, NAACP spokesman Thordy Ashley said the news about Wright was, quote, a bizarre turn, unquote. At the urging of the NAACP, the FBI has been conducting a civil rights investigation of Lee's death, which occurred hours after two men wearing white robes bearing the emblem of the Ku Klux Klan stabbed two black men outside a Concord nightclub. The NAACP asked for written statements from several people, including Wright. It was his three-page statement that handwriting experts have used to compare Wright's handwriting with the suicide note. David Crow, a handwriting expert in the state crime lab in Sacramento, determined shortly after Lee's death that Lee had written a note which said, quote, to Tammy and Tom, I love Yo-Yo, sorry, Tim. Tammy and Tom are Lee's sister and brother. But McNichol, a Los Angeles handwriting expert whose credentials include work on the Hitler Diaries forgery case and the identification of the remains of Nazi Josef Mengele, has concluded that the note was written by Wright, not Lee. Two other experts hired by the Mercury News have studied the note, Wright's handwritten statement and a sample of Lee's handwriting. They have concluded that Wright did not write the note. But adding confusion to an already complicated case, one of the experts hired by the Mercury News, Charlie Cole of Campbell, said Lee did not write the note either. The other expert who examined the documents for the newspaper, Sherwood Morrill of Sacramento, whose experience includes work on the wills of billionaire Howard Hughes, said that although he was sure Wright did not write the note, he did not have enough of Lee's handwriting to determine whether he wrote it. Well, it's interesting that we have all of these contradictions, and there are many, many other contradictions in the case. People can go back and check those out. But the people who were testifying about Wright here had previously worked on the Josef Mengele identification case, which we've discussed here at great length, and that was a farce. The late Mae Russell talked about the alleged discovery of Josef Mengele, which came, interestingly enough, as information was surfacing that not only had the United States arrested Mengele shortly after World War II and then released him, but that Mengele had not been an American citizen since the early 1930s and had moved freely in and out of the United States, the attempts to arrest Mengele being frustrated by elements of the U.S. national security establishment. Of course, the concern, the whole situation concerning Howard Hughes and his organization is very, very complicated. The Hughes, where the CIA leaves off and the Hughes organization begins is anybody's guess, really. The two are so closely interlocked. There was another interesting article concerning the Timothy Lee case and the possibility between possibility of connections between the aforementioned stabbing of two black men in Concord by people wearing Ku Klux Klan robes and another suicide similar to the Timothy Lee case. This from the San Jose Mercury of Saturday morning, January 25th of 1986. This is Dateline Concord, and it's headlined, Clues Have Cops Asking If Three Cases Are Related. Police said Friday they are looking for possible links between a triple murder Monday and two earlier acts of violence, the hanging death of a young black man and the stabbing of two blacks by white men wearing Ku Klux Klan robes. By the way, it should be noted that after Timothy Lee was found hanging, another black woman was found hanging In a similar fashion, they ruled that a suicide also, although it seems strange. Police said Friday they are looking for possible links between a triple murder Monday and two earlier acts of violence, the hanging death of a young black man and the stabbing of two blacks by white men wearing Ku Klux Klan robes. Police Chief George Straka, S-T-R-A-K-A, said investigators now have learned that the suspect in the triple murder is a former roommate of a man who pleaded guilty this week to the November 2nd stabbing of the two blacks outside a Concord bar. The police chief said the hanging death of 23-year-old Timothy Lee of Berkeley, although still considered a suicide, will be part of his department's review. Lee died the same night the other black men were stabbed in Concord. His body was found hanging in a fig tree a half mile from a party reportedly attended that night by the two robed men charged in the stabbing. But the two, George Harless and Harold Gallant, were under arrest hours before Lee's death and are not suspects in his death. We will be looking into what type of party might have taken place the night of November 1st, Straka said, what was transpiring that night and who was there. In the most recent incident, the triple slaying, police have issued a warrant for the arrest of Richard Allen Goodfellow, 21, of Concord. He is accused in the stabbing deaths of Nancy O'Hara, 23, her son Jesse, 23 months, and Paul Lepper. Straka said Goodfellow, the suspect, lived, quote, within the past 6 months, unquote, at the Sacramento Street home of George Harless, the 20-year-old man who pleaded guilty to the charges of stabbing Jeffrey Miller, 22, and Tony Hall, 19. Quote, I'll be breaking an individual loose to see if there is a connection among the three incidents, Straka said. His statement is the first indication that Concord police may have any doubt that Lee committed suicide. Lee's family and the National Association for the Advancement of Color People believe the fabric designer was murdered because he was black and gay. At their request, the FBI is investigating the case. Well, the final conclusion was suicide, and the same conclusion was reached in another similar hanging death of a black woman shortly after Timothy Lee. And again, people can make up their own minds. I'm highly skeptical that Timothy Lee committed suicide. The many, many contradictions in the case certainly would make it one of the most extraordinary suicides in history. And again, people, just as I think people should contemplate the disappearances that are taking place right in the United States, whereas most progressive progressively oriented political people tend to view that sort of thing as taking place only in Latin America. Again, Ku Klux Klan style lynchings don't just happen in the South. They happen right here in the groovy, progressive Bay Area. One of the things that'll get a lot of people killed is if you happen to find out something, if you happen to be a right-winger who finds out something about a political scandal or has critical information about a political scandal. Following article comes from the San Jose Mercury of about March 18th. This was sent to us by a listener, and apparently this was on March 18th. This is from the Mercury of March 18th. It has a small article headlined WedTech Trial. A close friend of Attorney General Edwin Meese claimed he got Meese to intercede on WedTech Corp's behalf for a federal financing package. A witness testified Thursday in New York City at the racketeering trial of Representative Mario Biaggi. Former WedTech Vice Chairman Mario Moreno testified that E. Robert Wallach, a friend of Meese's, told him in 1983 that Meese had asked then-Commerce Secretary Malcolm Baldrige to sign the necessary documents. Moreno said he was told Baldrige balked at signing because the matter was, quote, too hot politically, unquote, but 2 or 3 days later, the matter was resolved, unquote. Moreno did not elaborate. Baldrige died last year in a rodeo accident. Well, I can't comment authoritatively on the death of Malcolm Baldrige. The cause of death supposedly was a puncture wound in the abdomen caused by his belt buckle when his horse reared and fell on him. That may have happened, but what I wonder, in light of the fact that the WedTech case eventually hooked up with the Iran-Contra scandal in a way, and there were some definite connections there, and the Iran-Contra scandal produced a large number of very suspicious deaths. In light of the fact that some of the people in WedTech were supposedly talking about murdering somebody, I wonder if perhaps the puncture wound in Malcolm Baldrige's abdomen, and by the way, he died right over in Contra Costa County, I wonder if perhaps that puncture wound was not, in fact, caused by his belt buckle. We won't know for sure. Rest in peace, Malcolm Baldrige. Another curious death here, and again, I just downloaded a bunch of articles from my suspicious deaths file. This from the New York Times of Thursday, January 17th of 1985. Army general is found dead in apparent Virginia suicide. AP story, Dateline, Fairfax, Virginia. A 52-year-old Army brigadier general was found dead of gunshot wounds at his home Monday in this Washington suburb in what police and Army officials called an apparent suicide. A Fairfax County police spokesman, Warren Carmichael, said that the officer, Brigadier General Bobby C. Robinson, was believed to have died early Monday morning. Major John Barnum, an Army spokesman, said Monday that General Robinson's death, quote, was apparently a self-inflicted wound, unquote, but added that there had been no coroner's report. General Robinson served as Deputy Executive Director for Chemical and Nuclear Matters with the Army's Materiel Command in Alexandria, Virginia, Major Barnum said. The command is responsible for managing Army depots and overseeing the logistics of moving weapons and supplies, including nuclear weapons such as the Pershing II missiles currently being deployed in Europe. But the Army said this week that the general was not directly involved with the Pershing missiles. Well, one of the most interesting things about this is that he was Deputy Executive Director for Chemical and Nuclear Matters. Chemical warfare and biological warfare generally fall under the same command. I wonder if perhaps that general had anything to do with AIDS. It has been the contention on this broadcast for a long time and is documented, I think, rather compellingly in Radio Free America 16, which I'm going to be adding to shortly, that in fact AIDS is not a naturally occurring disease, but represents the first application of genetic engineering to biological warfare. In that sense, I guess we could view AIDS as the Port Chicago of biological warfare. Obviously, we can't conclude too much from the suicide of General Bobby C. Robinson, but I wonder whether perhaps his suicide had to do with the fact that a lot of people, including the Soviet Union, had begun to make noise about AIDS as a biological warfare weapon. At any rate, the man is no longer with us, obviously. An apparent suicide. Did he know too much, or did he just get depressed? We won't know for sure. Another person who apparently knew too much was the late Vicky Morgan, slain mistress of Alfred Bloomingdale, not only a member of Ronald Reagan's kitchen cabinet, but a member of the Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. Following stories from the San Jose Mercury News of Wednesday, June 13th of 1984, a UPI story Dateline Los Angeles headlined, Witness, Morgan planned to name names. Vicky Morgan, slain mistress to presidential confidant Alfred Bloomingdale, was planning a book that would name political figures, including presidential advisor Edwin Meese, a witness testified Tuesday. Sharon Porto, a friend of the victim's mother, Connie Laney, testified that Morgan, 30, was working on a book about her affair with Bloomingdale, a member of President Reagan's kitchen cabinet, until his death in 1982. Porto said the victim's mother told her the book would be Morgan's memoirs of people in the government. The book was to be about Bloomingdale and about government things, Porto testified. Vicky was going to name a lot of government people. Meese was one name I heard from Connie Laney. The testimony came during the second day of the trial of Marvin Pancoast, who was charged with the July 7th, 1983 bludgeon slaying of Morgan, with whom he lived. Defense attorney Arthur Barons, B-A-R-E-N-S, asked if the victim's mother ever told Porto about her daughter's involvement with political figures in the Reagan administration. The questioning, however, was cut short by prosecutor Stanley Weisberg, who objected on grounds that the testimony was irrelevant. Superior Court Judge David Horowitz later forbade any further questions about political figures. Well, we won't know any more about Vicky Morgan. Her lips were sealed, as I said, the article indicates. She was beaten to death, allegedly by Marvin Pancoast, before she was able to spill the beans, as it were. Well, that basically concludes the second installment of the Hit Parade, as I like to call it. The aforementioned Tom Davis books, the best single source for information, literature on this subject matter. Tom Davis Books, P.O. Box 1107, Box 1107, Aptos, California, APTOS, zip code 95001-1107. Tom Davis Books, P.O. Box 1107, Aptos, California, 95001-1107. Now, for people who would like to get a hold of tapes of One Step Beyond, all One Step Beyond shows are available for a period of roughly a month to 2 months after each broadcast. They are available from a tape duplication service called Archives on Audio. That same duplication service has all of the archive programs on permanent file. One Step Beyond on temporary file a month to 2 months after each program. All the archive shows on permanent file. The address for Archives on Audio, P.O. Box 170023, Box 170023, that is in Aptos, California. It is in San Francisco, California. Zip code 94117-0023. 94117-0023. The phone number, this ought to be easier, 415-346-1840. 415-346-1840.
1-800-520-1840, write or phone to the attention of Paul.
Great.
I just want to thank you for participating. Thank all of the callers. Thank the people who've sent in all of the terrific information. Got a flood of great mail this week. Keep it up. Don't be disappointed if I don't get to your material on air, because with that flood, I'm doing the best I can to keep myself afloat. Sometimes easier said than done. Keep up the good work. Tune in again next week, and God bless.